Good afternoon and welcome to today's joint program of the Commonwealth Club of California, the World Affairs Council of Northern California, and the Japan Society of Northern California, brought to you from the Hilton Hotel in downtown San Francisco. I'm Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome our radio audience joining us on one of the more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. Now, here to introduce our guest speaker today is my good friend Jane Wales, President of the World Affairs Council.
Thank you, Gloria. I welcome you to today's program, another of a series of co-sponsored programs among our three organizations. It's a distinct pleasure to be able to welcome Dr. Sadako Agata back to the Bay Area. Since becoming United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees, or Refugees Affairs, on January 1991, Dr. Agata has become a tireless advocate for displaced persons worldwide. UNHCR's primary mission is to safeguard the rights and well-being of the world's refugees and to assure that everyone can exercise the right to seek asylum and find safe refuge in another state or to return back home. Dr. Agata has maintained a long-standing commitment to human rights and brings a unique set of qualifications to her position. She received her PhD across the Bay in political science at UC Berkeley in 1963 and went on to a successful career both as a professor of political science and director of Institute for International Affairs at Sophia University in Tokyo. From 1982 to 85, she was Japan's representative to the UN Commission on Human Rights. And in 1990, she served as the independent expert on the human rights situation in Myanmar, just before her accession to the post of High Commissioner for Refugee Affairs. As I turn the podium over to Dr. Agata for her remarks, I thought it important to mention something that is on the website of the UN High Commission. It has a quote that was penned by Greek playwright Euripides back in 431 BC, when he wrote, "There is no greater sorrow on earth than the loss of one's native land." Dr. Agata has clearly taken that message to heart. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Agata.
Thank you very much for your warm words of welcome and introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it is really a privilege to be a guest speaker here today, and I'm very grateful to the Commonwealth Club of California, the World Affairs Council, and the Japan Society of Northern California for inviting me here today. And I'm very happy to be back in San Francisco, also for personal reasons. I've had two very happy years, rigorous years, though, studying at Berkeley in the 50s, and received my doctorate from the from UC Berkeley in 63. And I do have very fond memories of this unique area. Incidentally, I did spend yesterday at Stanford, and tomorrow I'll be going to UC Berkeley, and right in between San Francisco. So I think it's a very good spread of attending and seeing friends and old friends and new friends. It is exciting to share my thoughts, ideas, and concerns with people living in a state which so many continue to look to and think of as the future. I'm also very honored to be in the heart of an area in which migrants and refugees have played such an important role, not only when settlers moved west, but also in recent years. California hosts one of the largest and most varied refugee populations in the world, and many of these refugees have made a substantial contribution to California's prosperity. It is heartwarming to see that refugees can participate in the efforts, energy, and hopes of those who lived here before them in building a common future. It is of great encouragement to my office and to myself personally to observe the extraordinary achievements of refugees in this part of the United States. That refugees and migrants can both share in and contribute to the West Coast spirit of openness, tolerance, and freedom motivates us to continue in our efforts to create the same spirit elsewhere. Please continue to uphold that spirit. My office, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, was established by the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1951 to lead and coordinate international action for the worldwide protection of refugees and the resolution of refugee problems. Over the years, with forced population movements becoming broader and more complex, UNHCR was requested to become involved with other groups, for example, internally displaced people, returnees, these are refugees returning to their countries, and stateless persons. In the world today, there are almost 23 million refugees and others who are of concern to my office. This figure increased sharply in the early 90s, due, among other factors, to massive displacement caused by the Kurdish crisis in northern Iraq, by the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, and by the events in the Great Lakes region of Central Africa. On the other hand, the end of some long-standing conflicts in Mozambique, Liberia, Mali, and Guatemala, for example, were more recently has allowed millions of refugees to voluntarily return home. The overall number of people of concern to UNHCR has therefore slightly declined in the last 2 years. Ensuring the protection of all these people, including the provision of material assistance whenever necessary, is the core mandate of UNHCR. The search for solutions to refugee problems is the other fundamental aspect of our work. Traditionally, we promote three types of solutions. The preferred option is voluntary repatriation to their own country, when circumstances allow it. If this is not possible, the alternatives are integration in the country where they have sought asylum or their resettlement to a third country. UNHCR works in partnership with governments, international and regional organizations, and non-governmental organizations. Throughout its history, the relations of the office with civil society have been very important, especially because of its key partnership with NGOs. But increasingly also through cooperation with the private sector, an area that we wish to further develop. Perhaps a good starting point is to introduce a topic familiar to all of you, globalization. But looking at it from the opposite side, examining an equally powerful trend that is of great concern to humanitarian agencies such as my office, in which I would call extreme political localization. The action of local forces and the use of local resources can, of course, be a positive tendency. A decentralized administration, for example, allows the concerns of people to be addressed from a closer distance. But localization can take different, exclusive, and very radical forms. In its worst excesses, it negates ethnic coexistence, demonizes minorities, gives rise to extreme nationalism or regionalism, and engenders xenophobia. In some instances, this leads to the implosion of states or to their fragmentation. In other cases, particularly in affluent countries, societies become isolated and inward-looking. Their governments have no political incentive to commit themselves to international responsibilities. One may argue whether the globalization of finance, trade, communications, technology, and culture will not eventually counter the trend towards localization by absorbing it. However, what we see in many different regions is rather a widening of the gap between the two trends. Internal conflicts are the worst such symptoms, as demonstrated by the former Yugoslavia crisis, some of the situations in the former Soviet Union, and the current conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Needless to say, this affects our work. It inflicts untold suffering on civilians caught up in conflict. It also often causes forced human displacement. One may say that refugees, increasingly, are also the result of a trend towards extreme political localization. But is this a purely humanitarian concern? Certainly not. I think that business, for example, which thrives on the open exchange of goods, services, and information, must surely be as preoccupied as we are by this widening gap. On the one hand, sweeping globalization, which in some parts of the world is creating the most open and interacting society in history. On the other, extreme localization, which in many places is producing not only violence and displacement, but also large pockets bypassed by economic progress and prone ultimately to become a liability to the prosperity of much larger regions. Isn't this what the conflict in the former Yugoslavia has caused in Southeast Europe? Or the continued unrest in the Commonwealth of Independent States to a vast region, including the Caucasus and Central Asia? Isn't this a consequence of ethnic conflict in the Great Lakes region, one of the potentially richest areas on the African continent? Inward-looking and xenophobic attitudes have, of course, many dimensions beside the trend towards political localization. As participatory democracy progresses, people become more conscious of their role in their societies. Not any longer are public resources simply seen as belonging to an abstract and distant state. The sense of ownership of such resources by citizens has become stronger than ever. So have demands to have a say in how public resources are utilized. The concept of no taxation without representation, one of the mottos of the American Revolution, is being taken much further than in the past. Economic prosperity and instant, total access to information mean that citizens are becoming increasingly demanding on those who represent them. This evolution certainly contributes to building a responsible and dynamic society. Greater accountability by the state towards its citizens can lead only to better governance. But it is a process which is not exempt from risks, especially with respect to the people of concern to my office. It is a very real paradox of contemporary democracy that it may lead to exclusion. As citizens develop a sense of ownership of their resources, they sometimes tend to perceive as a threat those with whom sharing these resources is necessary or desirable. In extreme cases, this perception can be manipulated by unscrupulous politicians. In certain Western European countries, for example, refugee problems have been politicized and have become campaign issues, justifying at times the worst xenophobic excesses. This has often led to increasingly restrictive immigration laws and regulations. It has also affected attitudes towards refugees. The focus of refugee policies in many industrialized countries has shifted from protecting asylum seekers, recognized as refugees, to limiting and controlling potential abuses of refugee status. This is what the current European debate over asylum seekers from Kosovo shows once more. This is true even in a country like the United States. Despite its traditional generosity to asylum seekers and its large resettlement program for refugees from many parts of the world, its reactions have been much more defensive and control-oriented when large influxes of refugees from Latin America and the Caribbean threaten to multiply and complicate already substantial migratory flows from the same areas. While preventing such abuses is, of course, legitimate, this trend is worrying. It identifies refugees, among others, as a threat to the welfare of citizens. In so doing, it causes industrialized societies to lose sight of the fact that providing asylum, in many cases, is the most fundamental form of protection. It can save people's lives. This trend is seen not only in the industrialized world, but also in developing countries. The former president of Tanzania, Mwalimu Julius Nyerere, explained to me that when he was in office in the 70s and 80s, his country could not only provide asylum, but also gave land and grant citizenship to to thousands of refugees. Democracy has made significant progress in many parts of Africa since that time. This is, of course, very positive. One of the consequences of this progress, however, has been that the refugee issue has become politically charged to an unprecedented extent. Those governing African countries 20 years later, might reckon with nationalistic political forces, particularly at the local level, which oppose the granting of asylum to today's refugees and make integration in host countries extremely difficult. This tendency is contrary to the centuries-old tradition of African hospitality, but appeals to powerful ethnic feelings and localized economic interests, and as such, it cannot be ignored. The seeds of rejection and exclusion can therefore be also sown, and maybe particularly in the positive context of economic progress and the consolidation of democratic institutions. Obviously, I am not saying that democracy is bad, but I strongly believe that a democracy devoid of solidarity is incomplete. Democracy cannot be considered separately from other factors which provide all people with a sense of security. A window of opportunity still exists to limit the negative excesses of individualism that are mixed, perhaps inevitably, with the positive energies of economic development. We must learn to be inclusive. We must not consider weak, vulnerable groups such as refugees and returnees as an obstacle to growth or as competitors for scarce resources. We must think of them as men and women capable of making valuable contributions to society. Isn't that what this nation's history teaches us? Isn't that what we see in this state, California, in the city of San Francisco itself? We must think of refugees as persons in whose exclusion lie dangers of instability, but whose inclusion leads towards true nation building. Exclusion is not an abstract notion. Imagine that you have to abandon suddenly all that gives meaning to your life, family, friends, education, work, and flee from your home to another country. In refugee camps, I'm always struck and moved by young people whose hopes and aspirations have been destroyed by discrimination and violence in their home countries. As refugees, they have little or no access to education and employment. Their best formative years are wasted. You can sense their despair. They cannot hope nor envisage their future. It is an oppressive feeling which is particularly acute in situations of prolonged displacement. When refugee camps provide protection and asylum to those in flight, they can also become a very concrete symbol of exclusion. Refugees are especially prone to exclusion. They are by definition excluded from their own societies. They are often perceived as strangers, even intruders, by societies hosting them. Exclusion frequently becomes rejection in different degrees and fashions. There's a social form of rejection, for example, barring refugees from jobs, education, social benefits. Sometimes rejection takes silent but subtly effective psychological forms, and refugees are made to feel that they are unwelcome. Violent rejection also occurs, unfortunately, quite often, and refugees are then harassed, imprisoned, tortured, and sometimes deported to the country they fled from. What we observe in many countries is that exclusion occurs not only when refugees flee to a host country, but also when they return to their own communities. In Bosnia last year, I met a woman who told me that her worst experience as a refugee was to come back home to discover that her neighbor, a friend from a different ethnic group, did not want to speak to her any longer. This is made worse when forced displacement has been caused by internal, intercommunal, or interethnic conflict, and there are many of them today, and takes dramatic forms when, as happens with increasing warring frequency, displacement is one of the very objectives of conflict, and refugee return home to divided communities. I am often disturbed by what I see happening in developed countries. Great energy is spent in building wealth and power. I'm not arguing in principle against materialistic and individualistic values They are very useful in making a society solid, rich, and stable. To a certain extent, they are the engine of economic development. I also know that what used to be called charity, and which I prefer to call solidarity, although this term too may sound obsolete, cannot alone bring prosperity. Dealing with refugees, we know too well that aid may create dependence, which becomes an obstacle to economic growth. But let me make a personal reflection and tell you that what I find distressing, particularly in rich societies, is a strong force on the individual and his or her success, wealth, and career. What disturbs me as a chief of an agency which protects and assists extremely vulnerable people is to see many societies, many individuals, I should say, seeking prosperity without solidarity, that is, without a sense of sharing. The absence of solidarity, not only as a value, but also, most importantly, as a set of practical measures to protect the weak, inevitably excludes certain people. And in this exclusion lies a seed of division and conflict which will eventually erode societies from within. Solidarity is not just a moral value. Charity, said Fridtjof Nansen, the first High Commissioner for Refugees of the League of Nations, is realpolitik. Because the progress of technology is indeed making the interface between distant societies a daily reality, it is also essential to promote a concept of solidarity which goes beyond the boundaries of our own society, of our own country. Humanitarianism has always been international. Globalization may be giving it a new dimension, which we could call global solidarity. In order to promote global solidarity, international organizations, including United Nations agencies, such as my office, cannot limit themselves to seeking support from governments, important as their role may be in this respect. Today, no effort towards solidarity can be effective without the active involvement of civil society. And I would like to insist on another point. Business, as an essential leading constituent of civil society, can make a crucial contribution in this area. To quote United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, the business of the United Nations involves the businesses of the world. The private sector can play a central role in global solidarity. Business can, of course, contribute directly to the welfare of the disadvantaged in other societies by providing material or financial assistance to aid activities. Business can also make a fundamental contribution to the economic development and hence the stability of troubled regions, for example, in post-conflict situations, by creating economic opportunities in these areas. Civil society can play an essential role in creating a more positive image of refugees. In my country, Japan, for example, the concept of receiving and integrating refugees is comparatively new. If the public sector has been relatively prudent, the business community has, on the contrary, been instrumental in promoting and facilitating the integration of more than 10,000 Indochinese refugees in the last few years. And the same is true in countries with a longer, more solid tradition of refugee asylum, such as the United States or Western Europe. Small and middle-scale enterprises, in particular, have been and remain key players in providing refugees with opportunities for work and thereby with chances for self-reliance. These experiences will ultimately give back to the refugees the dignity and respect which derive from being full members of a community, the dignity and respect that they lost when they fled their country. But even more important, civil society, and I mean this in its broadest sense, including NGOs, academia, business, and so on, should work together with international organizations in countering inward-looking trends in governments and among citizens. As I said before, I am very concerned by such trends. My office, as the United Nations Refugee Agency, is already facing some of the immediate consequences. On the one hand, it has become much more difficult to raise funds for activities which are financed through voluntary contributions by governments. This is true for most humanitarian organizations. On the other hand, the political vision and energy that governments require to address crises threatening global peace and stability become weaker and narrower. This means that the humanitarian consequences of such crises will linger and perhaps worsen. There is an obvious link between unresolved conflicts, the instability which they cause, humanitarian problems, underdevelopment, and finally, renewed conflict. This spiral of recurrent instability almost inevitably has humanitarian implications, most frequently the forced movement of people. It also results in poverty, encouraging abuse and corruption, and discouraging entrepreneurship and investment. The link between the global impact of crises and their humanitarian and economic consequences is clear. Today, more than ever, no conflict is too remote not to be of concern to all of us, be it in Kosovo, Sierra Leone, or Afghanistan. Far from being purely a moral necessity, global solidarity therefore also has a political dimension. And I think that it is very appropriate to add, especially in this part of the world, that civil society is also on the front line of creative, innovative progress in the fields of management, information, and technology. I hope you will agree that such progress will be meaningful only if it is made in a spirit of solidarity. The refugees whom we represent long to be part of your vision and efforts. Let me conclude by saying that we, international humanitarian organizations, and you, the civil society of one of the most prosperous regions in the world, and one that has made tolerance and understanding its key values, have a common goal in creating and maintaining open and stable societies. We always ask ourselves this question: can civil society and international organizations work together towards prosperity and wealth, and at the same time towards greater equality and global solidarity? I think the answer is clear. Yes, it is possible. It is actually vital to find a balance between the pursuit of our own progress and prosperity and solidarity towards the others. We must work together towards societies which are both competitive and compassionate. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Agata, for addressing an audience of the Commonwealth Club and the World Affairs Council and the Japan Society. Dr. Julius Crevens, who is president of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct today's question and answer period.
Should I come down here?
No, I think
should I stay,
stay there and I'll lean over.
All right, fine. We'll share this.
We'll share. Thank you, Jane Wales, president of the World Affairs Council. Commissioner Ogata, we have a large number of questions, so let us begin. What countries are the most supportive of refugees? What countries are the least concerned?
Could I just have these questions? It's very difficult to say what countries are the most supportive and what are least, because contribution to refugee protection comes in different ways. Financial contribution is very important. Resettlement is very important. Receiving refugees, in large-scale refugees from neighbor countries, are all very important contributions. So I would say U.S. does play a very leading role financially, resettling, and so on. But I think we should not disregard countries like Guinea, which has received 700,000 refugees from across the border. These are realities that I think we should take into consideration.
What other international organizations are most effective in providing aid to refugees?
If it's a question of giving material assistance, there are many non-governmental organizations. America has quite a few of them, International Rescue Committee, World Vision. There are quite a few non-governmental organizations that are giving assistance, material assistance.
How should we deal with a situation in which a refugee population is so large as to threaten to undermine the social and cultural ethic of the host community?
Well, we face this very much. For example, when the Great Lakes region of Africa were faced with the outflow of Rwanda refugees mostly, 250,000 to Tanzania, and more than a million to Zaire. We really faced this problem. It is a very, very heavy burden, and I think it not only undermined the socioeconomic infrastructure of the neighboring countries to a large extent, but also to the security, because refugees, these were refugees fleeing conflict, and they brought the conflict into these countries. So we have to, we're trying to do several things. First of all, to have some kind of a security supporting mechanism that might bring down the security aspects. For example, in Tanzania, we are helping the local police materially, in training, and so on, so that they can manage the security aspect. But in whatever we do have to help the receiving countries in a way that not only the refugees, but the affected population are not totally disregarded.
The problem of failed states has complicated your job. Do we understand the causes of state collapse and the means of preventing civil conflict?
The failed state issue was something that we had not quite foreseen. I mean, we, most scholars and most political leaders, did not quite foresee this happening with Somalia. Now it's the Democratic Republic of the Congo. There are quite a few of them. And how do you... Well, first of all, most of these states have gone through conflict, internal conflict. So I think the conflict resolution mechanisms are important. What are the causes of the conflict? Usually power feud. What is the causes of the power feud? Usually social injustices, disparity in resource management, and also poverty. So it's a whole host of things that have to be done in order to reestablish states. I think states are still quite useful.
When the people of a country become refugees, what is the first action taken by the international community? Does the UN set up camps for refugees, provide support for camps, or what?
The first step, my office was established with a mandate to protect and assist refugees and to solve their problems. Whenever there are refugees that who cross borders and move into neighboring countries, the first thing we do is to be there, consult, and coordinate with the refugee hosting countries to set up appropriate protection measures like camps, or like sometimes they're mixed in the villages, and bring in international assistance. Those are the first things we do.
What can an individual do to help refugees? And please define your version of globalization and solidarity.
Individuals, I think, are a very important part of communities and civil society. I've always been faced with this question, and I have a rather hard time answering, because very often when I address university students, they all want to come and become volunteers and try to want to come to the refugee camps and want to do something for us. I usually say, keep studying. To those people, I keep saying, keep studying, because you'll be useful and called upon later. At the same time, so many people say, could I contribute money? I said, yes, fine, if that is the way. Because if you contribute your own money, you usually end up being more interested in the cause. And that's a very important part of linking up the cause with individuals. I would say the most important thing is to be aware, and you may not come across a refugee, but you may have a refugee in your neighborhood too. I think the most important thing is to understand their cause, be aware of it, and really show acts of compassion. And this is what I mean. The globalization gives opportunities, but some people feel very uneasy being left out of this globalization process. And I notice that some people feel left out of possible jobs that they might lose with the globalization trend moving. There's a lot of uncertainty, maybe among older generation or people who may be losing jobs, the weaker parts of society. So I think in this globalization trend, I think the leaders, which I don't mean political leaders, the people who are more policy leaders or opinion leaders should make sure that those people who are left out don't feel that way. I think more reaching out for those who feel left out. That's what I think is important in order to counter the inevitable move towards globalization.
And solidarity, your definition?
Yes, this is solidarity is really reaching out and caring.
What is uppermost in the hopes of refugees?
Returning home. The future is their they would like a future. And to be able to give them an idea of the future is very important.
Has the failure of the United States to pay its share of UN expenses reduced the ability of your office to meet its challenges?
Not directly, because we are based on voluntary contributions. But the United States arrears for the United Nations organization, and that is a treaty-based obligation. That does undermine the United Nations itself and undermines the credibility of the United Nations, but also the credibility of the United States.
You mentioned a total of 23 million refugees today. Does this include people displaced by environmental and economic hardship, or solely political and war-induced refugees?
Mostly political and war-induced refugees.
What is your commission's annual budget? How much of your work is advisory? How much is actual problem-solving?
My office's budget is about $1 billion. That's very small if you think of the number of people we are trying to cover. I think a lot of the work is actual problem solving, although we do advise others, whether it's a non-government organization or governments who are in a position to do something, we do give advice.
Funding is always an issue for your organization. UNICEF has improved its financial situation through cards, gifts, etc. Has UNHCR thought of embarking similar projects in order to raise money and awareness?
Yeah, I think UNICEF's budget is sort of around the same level as ours. About a quarter comes from the private sector through very active marketing. We have, of course, thought about it. But that kind of activity requires enormous human resources. And whether we will be putting in hundreds or lots of people into this activity is something we have to make a choice. At this point, I cannot afford to divert a lot of my human resources to marketing endeavors. At the same time, we should do much better public information sharing. There is an attempt in the United States to set up a U.S. committee for UNHCR. And I hope very much that they will be at the vanguard of public information sharing and supporters, constituency building.
You mentioned that the High Commission is working with the private sector. What are some examples of this collaboration? How do you ensure that these companies do not let their need for profit eclipse humanitarian mission?
We have had forums. There are businesses, corporations that have been very interested in providing some more humanitarian considerations and work. And I think especially those companies that are out in the field and see the need to work directly with various populations, they seem to come to us because they feel that humanitarian considerations will also facilitate them to do the right thing in various frontier countries like Azerbaijan, for example, or even many, many resource companies are facing these problems. So we are forming some kind of a collaboration with them. I don't think I should ever ask them not to think of profit. I think that's what they have to do. But there are many companies that do have social contribution funds. I think that is, I noticed in various multinational corporations, they do have that. How that is going to be used seems to depend, and this is what some of my friends in Japan told me, is that it's up to the staff to decide. And so the corporations and their own staff have a big role to play in how they contribute to the social equity, social responsibility, etc. So I think, again, a very wide range of public information sharing, and in my part, we should be giving, sending out messages of the importance of refugee cause in order to get the corporations to look at us from the inside, too.
Humanitarian relief often involves peacekeeping forces that actually have to create a peace to keep. How do peacekeeping forces work with the High Commission during humanitarian and refugee crises?
We've had very close cooperation with various peacekeeping missions. I think the largest scale cooperation we have had was in the former Yugoslavia during the Bosnian War. And they came to, these peacekeeping forces were deployed to help humanitarian activities. They did give us, we had to learn to live, to work with each other. The military had to learn what humanitarian work was, and the humanitarians had to work understand how the military worked. So there was an enormous mutual learning process in the course of Bosnia. I think I've gotten to know the, they flew. One of the things that we did in Bosnia was the history's longest airlift operation to Sarajevo, and the military ran it under our auspices. So we got to know a lot of the military terminology and also the military way of doing things, and I've got to know the NATO forces quite well. Right now in Kosovo, we are at a crossroads. I think the kind of low-intensity conflict that's going on in Kosovo cannot be contained just by civilians, and my office have people who are daily providing humanitarian assistance to the displaced persons. There are about 200,000 displaced in a very difficult conflict situation. And we also tried to give them some possibility for repairing their shelter in the winter so that they all don't freeze to death. But the military has not come in. And the closest that has come in so far, is the Kosovo Verification Mission, which is an unarmed but verifying mission of withdrawal of forces. The next few days, I don't know. There has to be stronger military presence, I think, in order to contain the situation in Kosovo. So it will be another big chance of peacekeepers required in order to contain the conflict situation and allow civilians who are under extreme danger to survive.
You mentioned a small number of refugees in Japan. Has Japan accepted refugees? If not, why not?
Japan has about 10,000 Indochina refugees were accepted, and they have been resettled in Japan. Japan is a party to the Convention on the Status of Refugees, and the convention refugees have been very few in being accepted. I think to begin with, the number who come to Japan is not that large. It's not a country that is based on migrants and refugees, but I think also it's a very insular country, rather monocultural, mono language, and so on. So it is not a country traditionally open to refugees. And I think this has been understood. There's much more pressure to do it, and I exert considerable pressure myself. The status determination process has been slow, and I hope that it will be much more accelerated and will be more transparent, even if the overall number may not be very big. I hope they would be able to do the reception of asylum seekers properly and as the demand arises.
Is repatriation always the first choice in resolving refugee issues?
Not for everybody and not for every situation, but for large-scale refugee outflows, I would say yes. If you have 1 million people, you cannot resettle them abroad to a third country, nor do they necessarily want to be resettled. They want to go home, most of them.
Afghanistan has produced the biggest refugee crisis in recent history. How can Americans be convinced of the need for attention to the crisis, and what can Americans do about the situation of women in Afghanistan?
The Afghan refugees were, at its height, was about 5 million under the Soviet occupation days. With the retreat of the Soviet forces, about half of them went back, but there's still about 2.5 million, 2 million, close to 2 million in Iran, another 1.5 million in Pakistan. Their problem have to be solved. And the real difficulty is that in Afghanistan, factional fighting continued, and now that factional fighting has been solved by the victory of the Talibans, which are very represent fundamentalist Islam groups. And that has brought about a lot of fear about their practices have been very discriminatory against women, especially from the point of view of West. It's a very different culture. And so that has caused a lot of human rights violation, fears, etc. I think the Talibans are settling down a bit. And I don't know the details, but if the peace agreement between the Talibans and the Uzbek faction realizes and Afghanistan stabilizes more, I think a little bit more practical approach will come through. I hope so, because the refugees both in Iran and Pakistan are wanting to go back now.
How is your work hampered by the United States sanctions against Iraq, that is, the lack of medicine to the civilian population?
Immediately, I would say, the sanctions and the military action. What I am afraid of, and we are always on the alert, is that would that create more people to flee from Iraq and move into neighboring countries? So we're prepared for this, but I hope it doesn't have to happen.
There are many refugee success stories of the 80s in the Silicon Valley, not to mention donut shops in Southern California. Are today's success stories always about going back to one's homeland rather than to a new country?
No. I think the million Vietnamese who came to this country, or I don't know the number, but a lot of people who came from Hungary in 1956 to the United States and various parts of Europe. There are many, many success stories of people who moved to a third country or a country that would receive them and have contributed a lot to the prosperity and growth culturally, too, of the recipient countries.
Please discuss the complexities of the camps in Zaire and Rwanda.
In Zaire, there were refugees who fled from Rwanda, and among those refugees there were military people, there were criminals, there were genocidaires. It was a mixed group of a very volatile sort. And the complexity was that we knew of this mixed group. At the same time, there were no ways of separating the refugees from those elements who should not be protected internationally as refugees. We tried to raise this issue. The Secretary General tried to get some peacekeepers into the camps. We tried to, and the Zaire agreed at that, to separate the military elements and take them into another camp, but nobody really came to help. And so this was the real problem, because at the end, because of these mixed group, and this was a very big issue then, but it's not totally exceptional. Many of the refugees' camps do tend to receive the armed elements, because they're usually the losers in a civil war that come out of the country and try to regain, hopefully give up or regain strength. And the challenge for us is to try to maintain the civilian characters of camps. So by trying to have forces come or policemen or whatever, law enforcement authority, to be able to separate these people. That is the most complex situation that started. In Rwanda today, there are refugees, and they're usually the Tutsis who are in Zaire. There are several camps like that.
What is the range of time that a refugee situation is likely to last? Will it be measured months, years, decades? And what are the forces that determine that?
Well, take the Indochina refugee situation. It took about 20 years to solve it. How did we manage? By making sure that at some point, when it was necessary, that refugees will be protected in the asylum countries. During that period, there was a lot of international support for the refugees, some of those who did not think they would go back, there was a resettlement. A lot came here. For those who were willing to go back, the Vietnamese government, after a lot of negotiations and pressure, they agreed to take them back, and a lot of them went back. So it's a combination of solutions, and it usually takes the more complex the cause of the refugee crisis, the longer it takes, and the more comprehensive the solution has to be. Months is probably not very realistic, but usually takes years. But there is today a real rush to solve problems. Say, I have been under pressure, you solve them, take them back. If you take them back when things are not ripe, they usually come out again and cause another conflict. So what I have to try to say, bring in the forces, mobilize efforts to solve problems, whether it's political, military, financial. The more efforts are mobilized, maybe it's quicker to solve the problem. Now, in Bosnia, after Dayton, it is not about 3.5 years. There are still, about 1.7 or 8 million people who are displaced, still, in the five republics. And with Kosovo added, it's quite a large number. It has not been solved. At the same time, it's 3.5 years only. We have to look at it that way, too.
Today's news of the alleged fraud and waste in the European Commission will reinforce the belief that many hold that large international bureaucracies, such as the UN, are all alike. Please comment.
I think that is a very simplistic observation. Before these allegations are proven, I do not want to make any comments. At the same time, large organizations have to be careful not to be bureaucratized. And, of course, the accountability aspect is very important.
What will be the impact of Europe's desire to reduce the number of refugees?
Europe, not all the countries, but some. In general, there is a lot of pressure by the asylum seekers. They come from northern Africa. France, for example, gets a lot from Algeria. Germany, which is the largest refugee-receiving country, gets a lot of requests from all the southern Balkan countries, East European countries. The pressure is very high. And so if you want to reduce it, I think you have to have a quick and effective and efficient status determination procedures, but also try to solve the problems in the countries of origin from which these people come.
How much does the success of your efforts depend upon the level of media attention that is given to a particular refugee crisis? How does media attention affect your work?
The media attention usually brings a lot of attention, and it's important. The only thing that I tell my media friends is, please maintain your interest, sustain your interest, not just one day, forget about it for a whole several months and then pop up again with a report. Sustain the interest. That would help me a lot.
Large numbers of refugees from Bangladesh have caused instability in adjacent parts of India. Is your office involved in this situation?
I think the population movement from Bangladesh to India is a very complicated one. They are not in any camps or anything like that. We'll try to assist the individuals as necessary. They're mostly urban refugees.
Do countries such as Iraq and Turkey cooperate in the resettlement of the Kurds or do they prefer to do it unilaterally? What will be the fate of the Kurdish people?
That is a very complicated question. The Kurdish people are minorities of a large scale in Turkey and also in Iraq. The northern part of Iraq is where we had a major operation. Many of them are back. The Kurdish people are in northern Iraq. Politically, there are two factions that do not seem to quite agree, and that has also continued to be a problem in northern Iraq. Some of them leave and seek asylum. From Turkey, the Kurdish people are minorities. I think many of them feel that they are not properly protected. Some leave and come to Europe. And some of the Kurdish Kurds in Turkey have taken militant approaches, terrorist approaches, which also causes more complication on the part of the Turkish government looking at the minority problem. So it's a very, very volatile problem in Europe especially.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for just one last question. During difficult economic times, it is easier to understand negative refugee sentiment. But what accounts for this sentiment now in the United States? Or is the sentiment better than I think?
Well, I think I should turn to you for that answer. You have the most prolonged period of prosperity, and I hope this will be translated into developing a stronger sense of sharing and what I call global solidarity, because it will be eventually in your own interest. And I think what the United States does affect the other countries. You do have a leadership position. If the United States, with all its wealth, economic prosperity, takes a tight control, I think all the others would follow. And that's what I would not like to see.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Sadako Ogata, Commissioner of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, for speaking here today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening over our nationwide radio hookup. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the World Affairs Council of Northern California, is adjourned.